We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hi, this is Glenn Wexler, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
History in 5 songs. With host Martin Popoff. A production of Pantheon Podcasts. Let's rock out with Martin.
Yes, indeed. Martin Popoff here. Welcome back to another episode of History in 5 Songs with Martin Popoff, brought to you by the good people at Pantheon Podcast. We are pleased, as always, to be part of this vast and always expanding Pantheon Podcast Network. We're available on Spotify, iTunes, and over 40 other podcast platforms. All right. This is episode 213. I'm calling this I Can't Unhear That. Boy, this is going to be a episode with lots of examples. I probably could have made 5 episodes out of what we're going to talk about here, but I'll try squeeze it all in. So the idea here is this idea of you hearing something about an album, somebody maybe possibly that you totally respect gives you an opinion about an album, or you hear a consensus, or we do a contrarian's dark horse panel and everybody kind of agrees on something that you didn't think of before, or just something like really, really specific that is pointed out that soon as somebody says this, you now cannot unhear that about the album. And in most cases, the whole idea here is that it's ruined it for you. It's ruined the band for you, the song, the album. So yeah, the idea is, somebody tells you something and that ruins the album for you. Another way of putting this is a wall goes up. You know, but the idea of I can't unhear that is also that concept of a pink elephant. When someone says, think about a pink elephant, and then it's in your head and you picture a pink elephant and you can't unthink the pink elephant, sort of thing. So yeah, the reason this came up, I'm part of this industry email group, and we were discussing, what were we discussing? Oh, yeah, the new mix of Black Sabbath Live Evil, and everybody's up and down about it, and this and that, and this is good, and this is bad, and it did get remastered, didn't get remixed, crowd noises, how's the guitar sounding? So the whole thing, you know, one thing people talked about there, and this is a minor example of this, actually, right off the bat, is the idea of, Ronnie James Dio and his vocals on the Ozzy songs. And, you know, there was an opinion sort of slated that Ronnie can sound a little dramatic at times, over the top, trying to be scary and spooky, and that he would do the whoa, whoa, singing along with the riffs, which was really annoying to people. Actually, I don't want to give it completely away because this leads to the next part from this discussion. So let's just dive straight into our first track and the first sort of category here. So yeah, take a listen to this. This is Roger Waters with The Last Refugee.
Lie with me now. Tree skies, show me the shy, slow smile you keep hidden by warm brown eyes.
Okay, so the reason I wanted to pick this, first of all, to lead off, it's sort of customary here to do this. This is my main example that I've ever thought of in my whole life of this. I can't unhear that. So why are we playing Roger Waters? So I love this album. This is the, I always have to look this up because it's a terrible, terrible album cover and title. Is this the life we really want? ? All lowercase. Oh, so annoying, right? This is my most played album of probably the last 20 years. Like I said in the group, you know, it's either this or Clutch Blast Tyrant. But I love this album to death, play it all the time, love the lyrics, love the music, love the variety on it. And then a really smart Music Swami friend of mine, Ralph Chapman, said, oh yeah, Roger Waters, yeah, great album. This. The drums are atrocious. right? So as soon as I heard that, I go, what? Really? I didn't really pay attention to the drums. Next time I go back and play it, I'm going, oh my God, yeah, I don't like the drum sounds. I don't like the choices of what's going on here. Now, this is Joey Waronker on drums. He's played for Beck, Elliott Smith, REM. He's the son of Lenny Waronker. He's almost known as a producer more than... The guy, obviously, is a wise music swami himself and a great drummer and all that stuff, blah, blah, blah. And when you hear what's on this album, you know, obviously these are choices made by Roger Waters, and it's a little bit like Ted Nugent making the choices for Cliff Davies of like, this album's not going to be about drums. And Roger Waters is kind of saying that too, right? So there's reasons, you know, everything's deliberate, everything is done with intention. But soon as Ralph told me that, you know, I went back and played this, and I can't unhear this idea of thinking about the drums and playing them and going, wow, the drum sounds really bad. Sounds like a machine here. He's playing practically nothing. It sounds disconnected from the song. And it really put a small damper on this album that I think is an absolute, absolute masterpiece from Roger Waters. I mean, Roger Waters is just a god to me. Creatively speaking, I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of controversy about Roger all the time about this whole, you know, Palestinian-Israeli thing, and the new controversy that he's getting a lot of heck for just dropped yesterday is him redoing Dark Side of the Moon, right? By the way, you know, I wrote a nice big fancy Dark Side of the Moon book that just came out not long ago. Comes in a slipcase, got the die cut on it and all that stuff. Get that at martinpopoff.com. But... yeah, so he's getting a lot of heck for that, and the first song, Money, just dropped, and he basically did the worst thing you could possibly do to make this the first song and have this sort of slow jazz with nothing much going on, starting it off. Later on, there's some really interesting things, but the beginning is like, you know, he's just basically stepping in it sort of thing, but that's a whole nother story. So yeah, this is my favorite best example of this, and what I wanted to bring up, again, to go back to that discussion about Black Sabbath Live Evil, that led into a discussion about Ozzy Speak of the Devil, right? Now, I love that album. Most people I know love that album. I love the drums on it, the production, blah, blah, blah. But somebody in the group pointed out that, oh, I can't unhear that there's Ozzy double-tracked in the vocals, right? And I'm thinking, ever since I was a kid, I've never heard that. It never crossed my mind, but I can't unhear it. It's a pink elephant. I can't unhear it now that it's mentioned. And, you know, I haven't even gone back and really looked for that. But, we argue about a lot of stuff. So I went back and looked for, like, they were also complaining about Brad Gillis's guitar solos. I thought that was fine. The drumming, oh, he doesn't have the groove of Bill Ward. I think the drumming's masterful on it by Tommy Aldridge. So I love it to death. But, yeah, so that without even going back and playing it and having it annoy me, that's already annoyed me. Just this idea that, oh, you really, you can clearly hear Ozzy has been double tracked, like recorded twice to make the vocals better sort of thing. I've got a whole category on live albums coming up, but that I thought was pretty interesting. Another couple examples in this specific department. This one's not really one that drives me, you know, or made me like it less, but so the Monkey Bars solo by Coney Hatch, famous, famous Canadian guitar solo. You know, I always thought originally, I just assumed, you know, back in the pre-internet days, it was by Kim Mitchell. So I find out that's wrong. It is Steve Shelsky doing that. That's even better, right? It's the guy in the band rather than the guy that produced the album. So that's great. But then, you know, you find out that it's actually kind of like a note-for-note retelling of Donna Lee by Charlie Parker. And that kind of lessened it a little for me because it's such a brilliant, brilliant, it's one of my favorite guitar solos of all time. So that's a funny one. Another one that's very, very specific. Well, here's a funny one. I remember Keith Olsen telling me, oh, Adrian Vandenberg, he can't write, he can only write songs in the key of A, I think he told me, right? So I thought that was kind of funny, and that's a you can't unhear it sort of moment. But don't know if it's completely true, of course. Another one that is along this very, you know, this literally is about as literal as you can get on this. John Bonham and his famous squeaky bass drum pedal, which apparently you know, it depends what versions you hear, because Jimmy Page has sneakily taken it out of various things. But you know, the record of where you can hear this, if you listen to the right versions, are Since I've Been Loving You. Definitely, that's probably the best one, especially at the beginning. The Ocean, The Rain Song, Over the Hills and Far Away, Dancing Days, The Crunch, Houses of the Holy, 10 Years Gone, Bonzo's Montreux, live version of I Can't Quit You Baby on Coda, All My Love, even all the way up through in through the outdoors. So that's pretty funny. That's a literal you can't unhear. So as soon as someone tells you that and you go listen for it, it's pretty much going to be on your mind when you play these songs. So I think that's a pretty funny one as well. Here's another one that came up in our group too, and I might have mentioned this before, but this one you have to check kind of carefully, and it isn't as extreme as the original that was talked about, but good buddy of mine, Monty Connor, who's part of this group. We talked about how a large portion of Motorhead Ace of Spades and a large portion of Aerosmith Draw the Line is in mono. And what does he say here? So he says the title track, Draw the Line. So when he said this, it's like, oh, I can't unhear that now. Draw the Line is compromised for me, right? And I remember walking around playing it and finding stereo bits here and there and thinking, I don't know. It might be a little exaggerated, but as he says, the title track, Draw the Line, is almost fully mono, as is Ace of Spades, the whole album. The only stereo thing on Ace of Spades is the drums and headphones. You can hear the sound moving around on the drums, but the vocals, guitar, and bass are right in the middle and don't move. I believe there may be a few guitar effects or overdubs that hit the sides here and there. So he goes on, I don't want to, there's other people in this group mentioned here. I usually kind of try not to mention names. But he did mention a couple other things that I thought were interesting. The first Michael Schenker Group album, the first Blood Rock album, go play the Blood Rock song, Wicked Truth on headphones, guitars right up the middle, no spread. Kind of interesting, eh? I guess my wider point here is, again, someone smart is telling you something you may not notice unless you're told. All of a sudden, it becomes the pink elephant. You go back to Ace of Spades and Draw the Line. You're thinking most of it's in mono. Or, put it this way. However much of it is in mono and, it causes us to, talk about these ones, basically, it means it's not a very sophisticated mix, right? And that bothers you in itself. So there's our first example. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
All right, back again here on History in 5 Songs with Martin Popoff. Let's go to our second selection here, and we shall discuss. This is our episode 213. I Can't Unhear That. Take a listen to this. This is Judas Priest with Love You to Death. Man, I'm playing this song and I barely even remembered this existed. I mean, you could have told me they had a song called this. I wouldn't even know. I've written 3 Judas Priest books, 4, I guess, I suppose. But the funny thing is I'm playing this and going, this is the first time I've ever heard this song. Pretty weird. But I've heard it many, many times, but yeah. So the thing about, this idea of I Can't Unhear That, as soon as you hear that the Ram It Down album is all drum machine, that really ruins that album for you. You usually think of 5 long haired guys making this music. And as soon as you hear that it's all drum machine, it really, really compromises, the record for you. And along this lines, I want to mention some other examples here in this faked sort of thing. Hearing Tom Scholz, I interviewed him in detail about this, and he's going through about how everything's drum machine and it's meticulously this and that. I can't unhear those later era Boston albums and think drum machine. It bothers me, right? Along the same lines, one of my favorite drumming performances of all time. You guys know this, ZZ Top Rhythmine. It's not Frank Beard. It's Greg Morrow playing the drums. And I think that's him on most of Mescalero, if not all of it. But yeah, I love the drums on that. I love the drum sound, the production. But it's, you know, this is a three-piece, and one of the three pieces isn't there doing this masterful, incredible performance all over the album. A famous apocryphal example of that from early on is, you think, Aerosmith, Get Your Wings, Train Kept a Roll, and Joe Perry, he's the guitar hero, I love my Joe Perry, right? And then it turns out it's Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter doing all that, you know, excellent soloing on Train Kept a Rolling. You know, you could do an entire episode about Kiss and this, how, you know, you were let down when that was Vinnie Vincent and not Ace playing that. You were let down when it was Anton Figg playing that and Peter Criss not playing that. You know, all the shenanigans that go on with the Psycho Circus album as well. So yeah, there's lots and lots of that that goes on. I mean, this all goes back to the Beatles and Paul McCartney playing the drums here and there and all that kind of stuff, right? Another funny one in this department, though, is Fleetwood Mac Big Love, right? You listen to that and you hear those sexual cooing noises, right? And you think it's Stevie and Lindsay and that. No, it turns out it's Lindsay speeding up his voice to sound like a girl. And so it's Lindsay, you know, playing with himself, basically playing his vocals with himself. And that kind of ruins Big Love for you. So that's a perfect example, right? You can't unhear that. Soon as somebody tells you that little bit of trivia about that song, it's kind of ruined it for you, right? So yeah, oh yeah, and another one that bothers me, it's a little bit in this department. Is it in this department? Let's see. Should I talk about it now? I suppose we can. I really hate those compromised lineups, because yeah, this is like the Kiss situation. You think of the cover of Bad Reputation, Thin Lizzy, with just the three guys on the cover. You think of Motorhead, March or Die, and kind of like the guest drummer in the band. You think of Max Webster, Universal Juveniles, and it's kind of like only three band members listed as being the band. You think of Diamond Head, pictures of just the two guys together. All of that really bothered me, right? So I can't unsee those pictures. I can't unread those credits. I just feel like the band is fragmented. And along the line here as well, along these same lines, you've got, you know, the faking of live album. That's another huge, big thing. Kiss Alive, Kiss Alive 2, you know, re-recording all the vocals and guitars and even the Van Halen. Wow, that was a really, you can't unhear that moment when I heard how much they had to completely redo Van Halen live right here, right now. And bring Sammy in to redo all the vocals because the other guys were like the speed or whatever. What was it? The tuning, the speed, something like that. Various problems. I mean, there's reasons you have to do this stuff. There's never reasons you have to do this stuff. What they tell you is the reason they have to do this is some mic didn't work or something, you know. The crowd noise thing is another big one, right? Like Blue Oyster Cult's live album using Edgar Winter's crowd. There are famous examples across jazz, prog, everything of having, you know, the producer put an audience on loop, so you hear the same whistles and screams every once in a while. There's stuff from bullfighting matches. I can't remember what example that was. You know, stripping in the girls screaming thing because of the whole Beatles thing. But yeah. I got a whole note here that I'm not going to read because this is going to turn out to be a long episode, but there's a lot of shenanigans that went on with Kiss Alive 2, especially in this department. Queen Live Killer, same sort of thing. Lots of cutting and pasting and overlapping. And yeah, as soon as you read these things about these live albums, you can't unhear it. You know they're not live anymore, and it really, really starts to bother you. And that happens with a lot of live albums, and people have that whole debate over the whole thing. How much is it going to bother you? And frankly, you know, the funny thing about this this I can't unhear that thing is half the time you know this stuff, you know it for a couple years, then you forget it, right? And then it's like, you know, how many times has someone said to you some cool musical fact or whatever, and I remember typing in Facebook messages back and go, I don't know if I ever knew that, or I forgot it. You know, there's this awkward phrasing you have to do to say, oh, interesting. It's like, did I once know that? So yeah, some of these things can fade with time in this whole idea of I can't can't unhear that. All right, let's go on to our third example here. Take a listen to this. This is Genesis with Silver Rainbow. Okay, so this one comes up because we just did a Dark Horse panel on the Genesis album, and I had a deep thought that, I hadn't really brought to mind. You know, you work through these things. I guess it's like therapy, right? You work through these things and you realize, hey, I'll articulate this for the first time, and then that thought ossifies for you, right? So my thought on this that was the deep thought is that I guess I always kind of considered this particular Genesis album, and I love this era of the band. You know, Abacab is my favorite Genesis album, right? My deep thought here is that I've always felt like this album to me sounds like a demo version of what the album could have been. It sounds like synth drums and vocals. Only when I went and gone through and played the whole thing and to prepare for the episode and go through it song by song, I started hearing all these extra things and the obvious work that goes into it. But basically, I've had this thought my whole life that this sounds like basically demos. It sounds like synthesizers and vocals. It's a synthesizers and vocals album. And what that led me to, and I didn't really recognize this or realize this, but it led me to this idea, and this is another one I could do a whole episode on, and I've been threatening to, right? Children's music, right? So it led me to this idea that Genesis has really sort of dumbed down and simplified, and they've crossed over into the realm of children's music. And along those lines, I've never been able to shake that thought about ABBA. I've kind of never been able to shake that thought about the Ramones. Even to a certain extent, I feel that way a little bit about Iron Maiden, Slayer, and Kiss. So there's this whole pile of bands that I've got this weird relationship with the idea of children's music with. And in a subtle, kind of semi-deep way, this Genesis album feels like that to me. It feels a little bit like, as I said in that Contrarians thing, I felt like they've crossed into the world of Huey Lewis and the News, which I also consider children's music, right? It's kind of funny. So that's one. So the theme here with our number three selection is my own thought. So this is when I've formulated a thought in my mind, and now I can't unhear that thought or unsee that thought or unthink that thought. Other examples. So we just did a panel on Van Halen, Different Kind of Truth, and everybody was talking about David Lee Roth's vocals and David Lee Roth's lyrics, right? So they were hammering down on this, and I respect all these guys, and I'm listening to their opinions, and they're wise music swamis, right? So by the end of it, I'm thinking, yeah, I guess that is the thing that's been bothering me, and now it's been reinforced by these guys I respect, that the lyrics are a little, as I said it, bumper stickery, and the vocals are a little high in the mix. I remember saying that, and then other guys kind of confirmed that thought for me. It's like, oh, it must be true, okay? So that happened. Another one that really feels like this, that is a problem, is get this one. So see what you guys think of this. Blackmore's Night isn't serious Celtic music. Okay? So is it serious Renaissance medieval music, Celtic music, folk music? I can't get past that wall. As I said in the beginning, there's a wall that goes up that I can't get past it and take it seriously. I can't get past seeing a picture of Richie and Candace and thinking there's something weirdly, you're not from the right place. You know, one of you is American, one of you is from Deep Purple. I just can't take it that extra step and see it as serious Celtic music looked at as art, as, you know, great, practitioners of this. I also wanted to mention William Walker has given me, some good ideas here as well, or some good examples of this. So this is kind of an interesting one. So what he says is, Black Sabbath, Budgie, and Motorhead, these literally might be my three favorite bands if they actually had guys who could sing. Now, I don't agree with that fact, but that made me think about definitely the idea that, so Budgie, he mentions Budgie. So over the years of doing all these YouTube shows, I've had lots of people say, yeah, Burke Shelley's singing, not so great or whatever. And then also every time I tried to turn people on to Max Webster or Kim Mitchell, you know, Americans, for example, say buddies who, you know, had no, you know, no truck in this, you know, in this discussion, they'll come away and say, oh yeah, pretty interesting. I don't like that lead singer. Right. And then I'm like, I go away and go, oh, it's never crossed my mind to not like Kim Mitchell as a singer. But now 3, 4, 5 people have told me that it's like, okay, kind of compromised it a little bit. Right. Here's another interesting, you know, concept that William Walker brings up. So he says, Deep Purple, Slaves and Masters, putting the Deep Purple name on a Rainbow album really smarts. So he, you know, he said the words really smarts, and I like that. It's like, because what really smarts is very quickly, you know, you call this the Deep Rainbow album, right? So soon as you say that, so soon as you hear Deep Rainbow, you can't unthink that. It's the pink elephant, right? So now that's all you think about when you think of that album. You know, it's really compromised the artistic integrity of the album, Deep Rainbow. So that's kind of the same thing as William saying it really smarts. Let's see. Okay, so he said this as well, and I thought this brought up a great concept. But again, like I say, this episode, I mean, this could be 5 episodes, but he goes, Gary Moore hated my favorite Gary Moore albums, the 80s hard rock ones. So that's a huge can of worms there. The idea of when, you know, an artist decries some of their work and it's something you really like. Neil Peart was famous for this, of thinking all the 70s stuff was a little embarrassing. Joe Elliott decrying, you know, their participation in the new wave of British heavy metal and saying On Through the Night wasn't such a great album, right? And everybody loves On Through the Night. So that's an interesting one as well. You can't unhear the artists themselves putting down their own work that you really like. I thought that was pretty interesting. A couple other ones in this one. When you hear that a certain album by a band was supposed to be a solo album, you know, you think of Black Sabbath, Seventh Star, you think of Dee Snider, and that Twisted Sister, the last one, right? Love Is for Suckers. You think of Miles Goodwin, April Wine, Forever for Now. Other ones are when you know that there's two drummers on an album. We've kind of gone down that road a little bit of that, you know, the Motorhead March or Die thing is an extreme example, which really is annoying, right? You know, Phil Taylor drums on one song. Who else drums on one song? Yeah, Mickey D drums on one song. Drums on all other tracks, Tommy Aldridge, right? So Tommy Aldridge, Motorhead, that doesn't really go together. You know, he's not in Motorhead. So that's really annoying too when that happens. So you can't unhear the idea that Motorhead really doesn't have a drummer on March or Die, which, you know, it just puts a damper on it, right? All right, let's go on to our fourth selection here. Boy, I don't want this episode to be too long. Take a listen to this. This is Motley Crue with 5 Years Dead. Just like Love It to Death. I didn't even remember this song existed. I go look up on Wikipedia. It's like the first song on side two. It's like, what? I'm playing this. I'm going like, it's like I've never heard this song before. So the idea here is I can't unhear all the crappy things about Motley Crue, you know, starting with Vince Neil and the Razzle Death, you know, all the drunken bad behavior, the drugs, the not being great to the women sort of thing, the Vince phoning it in on vocals, the Vince not keeping it in shape, all the recorded tracks, all the rumors about, you know, bass and, you know, the fight with Mick Mars, the absolutely, we are absolutely emphatically retired, but now they come back and they just do a lousy job of it, blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on and on and on, right? So The idea here is that this is my best example of a band where they've just blown all the goodwill with me, you know, inexorably over time, to the point where I can't listen to Motley Crue anymore because I just think they're jerky guys, right? You know, even though have I met all of them? I've definitely interviewed all of them, blah, 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 you know, I think I have, and repeatedly, and they're quite nice guys, you know, in person to me, anyways. You know, when we talked, but yeah, I thought that was you know, the best example of that. The best example universally of that, of course, is Ted Nugent, where people are really upset about the hunting thing and the guns thing and the being the big right winger thing, and that's really, you know, caused big problems with his career. You know, what else do we got in this? You know, I think I'm going to skip some of these. Well, yeah, I'll mention this one as well. So what about the whole sperm thing, right? You know, Black Sabbath, a Spiral Architect, song about sperm, Load and Unload. You know, the cover art, blood mixed with sperm, right? Sperm in the clouds of mirrors, right? So the idea here, Black Dog, you know, it's just a song about a dog. Trashed, it's just a song about, you know, getting drunk and racing around the car on the rent, you know, the track on the rent-a-car. So when you hear certain things are about something that you thought it was like some big lofty, cool idea, and then all of a sudden you find out, it's about sperm, right? That sort of thing, which is kind of funny. And that again could be a whole episode, right? I'm sure there's tons and tons of great examples of songs that you think are this big lofty theme that you realize, you know, I just wrote that about my cat, kind of thing, right? Let's see, what else do we got here? Okay, well, let's skip that. Let's move on to our next selection here. Take a listen to this. This is the Pat Travers Band with Making Magic. Of course, this is the live rendition from Go For What You Know. And what is the theme here? I can't unhear the fact unread the fact that this live album was not recorded outside on a huge sunny day in California at Day on the Green playing to 80,000 people, right? So I've mentioned these a few times, but, you know, MC5 Kick Out the Jams really bothers me that that's recorded at the Grandy Ballroom, because I look at that album cover front and back and I think it's like a big outdoor festival gig, right? And that's what it sounds like to me, right? Same with this Pat Travers Band album. I don't think there's a more glorious, amazing, outdoor sounding killer performance live album, and that's why people love it so much. And then that's reinforced by the live pictures, or, you know, the outdoor live pictures on the back, right? Foghat Live, exact same thing, live pictures on the back. It looks like a big crazy outdoor, you know, everybody's getting sunburned kind of gig. And that's recorded at the Dome Arena, a 4,000 seat indoor arena just outside of Rochester, New York. You know, talk about putting a bummer on it. Henrietta, New York kind of thing, right? So yeah, those are three big examples of that. And, you know, a little more obscure, and I don't have examples of this, but I definitely have noticed that I can't unhear that when I find out that a certain live album, you know, where it's a band you associate with a certain place, say they're an English band, and you hear their live album was recorded in, you know, Boise, Idaho, or something like that, right? That sort of thing has bothered me from time to time as well. When you hear the live album, or you know, you're kind of picturing it as one concert, but then you find out that it's recorded. This one's from 1988, this one's from 1990, halfway around the world, you know, these three tracks are from 1984, whatever. You know, when it's really broken up like that, you know, that's an extreme example, even breaking it up by year. But yeah, so that sort of thing has bothered me with live albums as well. So yeah, you've got the faking it on live albums, you've got the outdoor-indoor situation, which is one of the big ones for me, oddly enough. I mean, I spent my whole life picturing Kick Out the Jams, Foghat Live, and Go For What You Know as being recorded outside in front of 80,000 people, right? Not really the MC5, but 20,000 people, right? We're about to riot and burn down the city and all that kind of stuff, right? So that's a funny one. And then, like I say, this idea of these albums, finding out what cities they're recorded in, and you know, basically your thought is, it was just another gig of the 50 that they did. You know, it was just happened to be the middle one, and yeah, you know, hey, let's get the recording equipment out and do this one. It just sometimes seemed just very random, right? The way they did this. All right, boy. I told you it was going to be a long episode, and it has been. So that is your various examples of I Can't Unhear That. If you like the show and want to support future episodes, please go to ko-fi.com, rhymes with coffee, /Martin Popoff. Hit that red support button. Buy me a coffee or a pint. This week, I would like to thank Andy at Black Sugar Transmission, Jeffrey Coggins, Rob Karhakangas. Rob, I've known you for years. I've never really gotten that pronunciation right. I'm sorry. Monty Olson, Augustin Garcia de Paredes, Steve Polari, Barry Sanders, Petri Taskinen, and William Walker. Thank you all very much. You can go to martinpopoff.com. For all your book needs. A few things coming down the pipe coming up. Got a new book deal to do something pretty interesting. But right now, the latest are The Cure, the David Bowie, the AC/DC, and the Pink Floyd, the Big Lush Coffee Table books. I signed them, sent them out from the office. PayPal buttons there. Blah, blah, blah. I know you're all asking about Kiss at 50. You know, and I have to answer this question all the time, and it takes a lot to answer in writing. But the idea is, you know, these things go up on Amazon ahead of time, and it's kind of annoying because... basically, I won't take pre-orders. I don't want to take people's money. As I always say, I don't start telling people about these books until I see the heavy boxes sitting across the floor. And then the fact of the matter is I physically have them and can send them out as fast or faster than Amazon gets them or whoever, right? Whoever your distributor is. So that's the point. You'll hear about them because I have my database and I'll send out a message. But I don't take people's money ahead of time because then that's just hanging over for me for however long it takes for the book to actually happen. So yeah, just be patient. Wait for me. I do better if you get it from me. Certainly a lot better than you know, some of these things I don't even get royalties on. Like some of them are just like right for hire and that's it. So the only way I make any extra money on them is by getting them through me, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's the story on the Kiss at 50. So go to the Facebook page. Let me know what other examples of I can't unhear that you have or unthink that or unhear that somebody told me that or unhear that on the record and now it's bothering me. I'm sure there's many, many, many other examples. For now, go play that Roger Waters album again, man. Give Roger some love. I just think that's an amazing album. I'm kind of interested to hear this Dark Side of the Moon thing, but man, is he taking a drubbing for that. Talk to you later.
Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.